hopefully you can all hear me. If you can't, I'll shout louder. I wanted to start off, I guess, with a plea, in a way, that whenever we talk about the Middle East, and whenever you read in the press about this question, the words that always come up are the words stability and moderation. When you read how much of the Western press describes countries like Egypt or obviously Israel, Jordan, Saudi Arabia for that matter, the term moderate is always included before that. If you talk about Iran or Syria, they're of course extreme terrorist states, etc. And I suppose one of the things that becomes so clear in the last few months is in fact how utterly, it's always been wrong, but even more wrong it has actually become. So I've often spoken to my journalist friends and tried to plea with them to say, can you please not include the word moderate before you talked about Egypt under Mubarak or Jordan under King Abdullah? Things are now changing. My point being that the language that we have been using, or much of the West uses about this part of the world for so long, has been so wrong. I want to just take a bit of a different tack to the first two speakers and give a bit of a sense of where the US and Israel sees the Arab revolutions and how they're concerned about how it's not going to maybe work that well for them. There was a fascinating piece a few days ago in the New York Times, which is always, I think for me, his master's voice when it comes to the White House. And it was talking about the potential ramifications post the killing of bin Laden in the Arab world. And I wanted to read you a couple of short quotes, and it's generally, of course, always a few US officials say, which is my favourite expression in the New York Times, and it gives a bit of a sense of how the Obama administration feels about these uprisings and how they're going to try and manage them better. Let me read you a few short quotes. Even before the bin Laden raid, officials said, Mr. Obama was casting about for ways to tie together events in the Middle East. White House officials had weighed a speech in which the president would link the upheaval to the stalled Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations, a process that seems, if anything, even more paralysed after the recent agreement between the PA and the militant group Hamas. Again, their language, not mine. Given that, officials said, the current plan is for the president to keep his focus on the broader changes in the Arab world rather than to present a new specific plan for reviving the peace talks. From the earliest days of protests in Tunisia, Mr. Obama has balanced his desire to paint an overarching Arab narrative with the need to evaluate each country on its own terms. He has judged the same idealistic and realistic impulses that have marked his approach to domestic issues. And one other short quote I think is very instructive here. This gives you a bit of a sense of where Obama gets his information. Be afraid. At night in the family residence, an advisor said, Mr. Obama often surfs the blogs of experts on Arab affairs or regional news sites to get a local flavour for events. He has sounded out prominent journalists like Fareed Zakaria of Time magazine and CNN and Thomas Friedman, a columnist of the New York Times, regarding their visits to the region. I guess speaking to Arabs themselves is a bit too far, much to expect. Zakaria said he's searching for a way to pull back and weave a larger picture. And the reason I read that, I think, is to really get a sense that the narrative that we're constantly sold, even in the last few months by much of the press, including in Australia, is that America is almost kind of trying to be a handmaiden to the revolutions. We know that's not the case, but that's how we're being sold this message. And if you read a lot of the Israeli press and the Israeli position, both in the public sphere and the media and elite sphere, they are petrified with what's going on. Fear is an understatement of how Israel feels about these revolutions because, as the other speakers have alluded to, there's no doubt that Israel cannot maintain itself in any kind of sustainable way, either as an occupying nation or just as a country, without dictatorships around it. You cannot maintain a siege on Gaza, as one example, without regional allies such as Egypt. The other speakers have alluded to the fact that the so-called new Egyptian regime, which is the old regime dressed up in a new coat, has talked about ending the siege on Gaza. I say let's wait and see if that actually happens. It may happen, it may not happen, but the truth is that many of us fear that it won't happen for a few very good reasons. One, the Egyptian military receives $1 to $3 billion of US aid annually. So you can imagine that the pressure put up by Israel and the US on Egypt to not change that is immense. Secondly, the Egyptian elites who are still in control of that country, generally speaking, have no intention of giving up their close military and diplomatic and financial ties with Israel and Egypt. However, as Gennaro rightly said, public protests in Egypt are saying something different entirely. And the fear, of course, is which is reflected in the Israeli political and media debate, is that what happens if the Egyptian people have a say? What happens if they actually have their own perspectives put forward? And you know what public opinion in Egypt, how it's changed. There was a Pew poll, American polling company that did some surveying in Egypt in the last month, talking about Egyptian public opinion since the revolution in end of January. And it found two major things. One, the majority of Egyptians polled saw America as an enemy of Egypt, which is not surprising considering the fact that Mubarak was backed for 30 years by the US. And secondly, the fact that the majority of Egyptians wanted to end the peace treaty with Israel. The next question was not to ask, do you want to go to war with Israel? No one is saying that. But there's a difference between not being at war and actually also having a so-called peace treaty. As I think, and Janara alluded to this, whenever this issue has come up in the last few months, the question has always been, what happens if the peace treaty with Israel is ditched? But realistically, the question is, what exactly, who has been benefiting from that peace treaty? There has not been an official war. That's good, yes. However, the Egyptian people have not benefited at all. There are 80 million of them. They have not benefited one bit, apart from a handful of those like Suleiman who are making money from that relationship. No one's benefiting. The rest of the Arab world is not benefiting, the people themselves. The Egyptian elites certainly have been benefiting. The Israeli elites have been benefiting as well. And you know the sense of how the fear is felt in Israel by hearing the comments by a lot of Israeli leaders in the last few months. Ehud Barak, the Israeli defense minister, a few months ago was in New York on his regular visits to ask for more money, which is what they basically do in DC. And he was speaking to a New York Jewish organization raising money for the IDF, which obviously needs more money, clearly, and was talking about how Israel sees this conflict at the moment, post the 25th of January in Egypt. And Barak's message arguably was no different to what it would have been had he said it 40 years ago or 50 years ago. And I haven't got the direct quote in front of me here, but I can paraphrase fairly accurately. We are an island of stability in a sea of madness. We as Israel are the country that is holding you, America, together. If you let us go, we are screwed. Again, I'm paraphrasing a more elegant language than that, but that's essentially what he was saying. And the result of that was the US Congress 2 weeks later gave more military aid to Israel, point one. Point two, as many of you will be aware, Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, is visiting America in 2 weeks and giving a speech in front of the now Republican-controlled Congress. And inevitably, we can almost write that script now, what he's going to say. He's currently, Netanyahu, travelling through Europe. He's in London shortly. And the message is twofold. One, that the recent Hamas-Fatah deal is a disaster for peace. His words, not mine. And secondly, that the West needs to understand that there are other priorities apart from Palestinian. The threat is still from Iran. That's how they say it. Iran is the threat. The focus has to be kept, according to them, on Iran. Yeah, peace with the Palestinians would be nice, but, you know, that can wait until the Iranian issue is managed. And we can almost predict what Netanyahu will say in front of the Congress, not least because he's invited by John Boehner, who's the head of the Republicans in Congress. And there is, as everyone here will well know, pretty much unanimous support for Israel and the US Congress. It's almost beyond support. It's almost to the point of, I don't even know what to call, like sort of a weird obsession. There was something put forward in the Congress last week to condemn two things, the Hamas-Fatah deal, two, to suggest that US funding to the PA be entirely cut, which arguably is not such a bad thing, which I'll get to in a minute, and thirdly, to sort of say that Israel is an unquestioned ally and we have to support it no matter what it does or says. I mean, the language of these resolutions is so remarkable as to be almost mind-blowing. And the other two speakers have touched on this issue with the Palestinian Authority and Hamas and how the Arab revolutions are changing this debate. Many people have argued, and I would agree with this, that probably one of the reasons why Hamas and Fatah have reconciled, inverted commas, is because two things. One, I think Hamas fears that some of its support base is now crumbling or at least being questioned in Syria and certainly Iran. There is domestic tensions in both those countries. There is talk about Hamas moving from Damascus in Syria to the UAE, I think, from what or actually Qatar, which one can only read as an understanding or belief that there is uncertainty about Syria on a range of issues, which is pretty clear seeing what's happening there at the moment. But the fundamental point is still that the Netanyahu government is focused and obsessed with this proposed UN vote in the UN in September to recognise a Palestinian state. And I think one of the things that all of us need to be very aware of is that we're moving towards a situation, in my view, of recognising something which doesn't actually really exist. We're moving towards a situation of saying, this is the narrative which we're being sold, the Palestinian Authority has been working wonderfully well for the last years. It has built up institutions for a state. There is now relative peace. Security is relatively maintained. And therefore we should, thank you, we should move towards supporting what the PA has been doing, and Hamas can just get on board and support that as well. The truth is, of course, an inversion of that entirely. If you look at any Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, let alone UN reports, EU reports, what's happening in the West Bank is the opposite of that. It's essentially is a maintenance of the occupation rather than ending it. It's understanding the fact that what Israel has done in a classic colonial sense is forcing and arming and training Palestinian Authority troops to help them maintain the occupation. That's the vision. There is no vision to end an occupation here. Zero. And the concern that many of us have is that Hamas is buying into that. That Hamas, which is framed in much of the West as this sort of revolutionary resistance force, and at times it has, with many other issues alongside it, is buying into the PA narrative for two reasons. One, because, as I said, their power base elsewhere maybe is being questioned. And secondly, I think because they may be realising that their support in Gaza is not as strong as it once was, which it's not. And the truth is that many people in Gaza, including many friends of mine, are increasingly pretty pissed off with how Hamas is ruling Gaza. Yes, the PA doesn't have much influence in Gaza because there's been massively cracked down and vice versa. But the reality in the West Bank these days is essentially a quasi-police state. That's what the PA has constructed. So the narrative of what Israel and the US, or Israel particularly, is trying to sell based on what's happening in the Arab world is to say the UN vote would be a disaster. And even if it does happen, and at this stage you'd have to say the chances are not bad that it will happen, there'll be something in September in the UN, the question is what happens then? And what does happen the next day? As if somehow nothing's going to change, of course, overnight. But what happens ultimately to the Israel-Palestine conflict? I think one of the things that we need to be aware of here is challenging two things, and then I'll finish. One, an understanding that the occupation clearly is not going anywhere, which is such a self-evident thing to say, but needs to be said over and over again, because the idea of the PA going to the UN is about saying the occupation will end if we do this. Not overnight, but we're moving towards that. The opposite is true. The opposite is true. Just yesterday, for example, in the West Bank, when there's weekly, in fact almost daily, protests against the occupation and the wall, violence against Palestinians, in fact, is increasing by the Israelis and the IDF, and indeed settlers. Not decreasing, which is not surprising again, but needs to be said. And secondly, an idea of what the vision might be for some kind of peace. Now, I have my own views. I'm guessing most people in this room have certain views, which I'm going to radically suggest is more one state than two, but that can be discussed maybe during the weekend. But in some ways, moving towards those kind of ideas is about saying that what is happening in much of the Arab world is about two things. One, supporting how the Palestinian question has not been the only issue that people are protesting about, goes without saying, but it has been central. And you haven't read much in the Western press about that at all. In fact, most of it's been talking about the repression of their own governments, which clearly has been central. I'm not suggesting that food on the table is somehow less important than freedom for Palestine. It's not. However, in much of the Arab world, what the Palestinians have been calling for years is supported by the vast majority of the Arab people. And therefore, an attempt to try and crush that or not support that or back different kind of leaders by the US is exactly what they want to do. So finally, I would suggest that we need to see and hear what the Israelis themselves are saying. Be aware of it, challenge it, question it, and more importantly, being in Australia, put up alternative perspectives to say to journalists and the media and civil society groups that this conflict and what's happening in the Arab world should actually be seen. If Israel was a mature country, which it's not, it actually would be the best opportunity imaginable. The best chance imaginable to imagine a long-term future if Israel wants to maintain itself as a Jewish state, which it says it does. In fact, it's chosen the opposite direction. I think all of us need to be aware of that, talk about it, and more importantly, challenge the idea, what we read in the Western press, particularly here, about this question. Thank you. Thank you.